Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan.
Bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners, from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
Alright, here we go.
Hey, look, we're back on video. Where's your mic?
Oh, yeah, I suppose that would be helpful,
wouldn't
it?
Amateur.
How are the people going to hear these words? Alright.
Hey, look, who's hanging out on my couch?
Must be time for late night conversations about sources.
Is that what my favorite this? Thing?
So we've come to you a few times in this video format because you people feel like that listening isn't enough, which I personally am not a YouTube podcaster. That's okay. We don't you know, judge.
Isn't it obvious that we're not YouTube podcasters?
We're kind of old school. But we do like these because they are fun to sometimes have conversations about sort of the state of Mormon history, things that are going on, things that we find interesting. And one of these is the unbelievable amount of things that have been digitized by the LDS Church Historical Department. And to me, that's one of the most exciting developments that we've seen lately.
It always reminds me, you know, ex-Mormons will be like, the church is hiding stuff. They just go search their archives first. Before you say that, go search the archives first. Have they historically always done a great job at it? No. Are they doing a better job at it now? Yeah.
This is really kind of a fun topic to talk about because we are friends with so many of this kind of our generation of historians that are making incredible strides. Part of the problem was historically you didn't have historians in the historical department. Part of the larger story is the Leonard Arrington experiment that, depending on which side of it you fell on, was either a great success or an exercise in this is why we don't let historians in here. So we're seeing the pendulum kind of going back the other way now. And it is interesting, you know, this it's become this trope to say, oh, they're hiding everything. I think if you did a really good survey of people who say that, generally speaking, those are not people who are actually doing research.
Can I invoke Buchanan's law for a moment? So there is also this weird tension that happens in Mormonism, and you'll see this like with Warren Jeffs, for example. Warren Jeffs, like Joseph Smith and other prophets, had an ordained scribe that he took everywhere with him, and Mormons write down everything. And so even the things that make them look guilty, they write down a lot. And so there's also this weird thing of, we have an excess of documents. We have an excess of writings. And that's why Mormon history is so fun, because there's so much to pull from and dig from. And you'll be like, well, why would Warren Jeffs write down his crimes? Why would the church, you know, write and publish stuff that they don't know, you know, that could make them look bad? Because sometimes they don't think it makes them look bad. That's not what we're talking about tonight, though. But I do think that that's also an interesting thing that happens in Mormonism, where we write everything down. We're record-keeping people.
So tonight we wanted to talk about a recent release that was pretty important. So we were actually going to talk about this last year, but then, not really out of the blue, because we had inklings it was coming, But this is when we talked about the 1886 revelation was released, which obviously was a pretty big deal. So this one, that one kind of got ahead of this one. So we're going to talk about this now. So last year, the Church History Library released digital high color, you know, full color, high res scans of the Heber J. Grant journals. And this was pretty important because this was a record that covered 6 decades of Mormon history. So going from the 1880s right up until his death in 1945, this was a big one. And this was kind of has an interesting history. So back in the early 1970s, when Mike Quinn is a young research assistant for Davis Bitten, one of the first collections that he gets into was the Heber J. Grant journals. And as he was wont to do, he typed tons of excerpts. The way he tells it, Davis gave him sort of parameters. He was really interested in things like dreams and visions, but he basically just told Mike, go into it and, you know, excerpt out whatever you think sounds interesting. Mike said when he came back with several hundred pages of excerpts, Davis's eyes got real big. He gave Davis a copy, kept one for himself, and went on his merry way.
Thank goodness he did that, though, because we have a lot of good stuff from it.
So for years, we have been largely reliant on Mike's notes because the collection really hadn't been opened until now. And
for anyone that would doubt Mike's notes, Mike's notes are a problem sometimes in how detailed they are. Ask anyone who's had to edit Mike Quinn.
There was nothing so minute and detailed that it couldn't be made more minute and detailed.
Well, the joke about Mike Quinn is that his footnotes are longer than his books.
And that's not a joke. That's just a very good observation of his work. Bless his heart. So, yeah, after several decades of them not being available, all of a sudden, here they are. Thousands of pages. So it was kind of an interesting record, too, because he kept kind of 3 types of journals. He would sometimes do handwritten journals in a bound journal, and these would often be just kind of little notes, more or less, to himself.
And this is Heber J. you're talking
Heber
about.
Heber J., yeah. And so what he would do is often go back and either himself flesh them out, or later he would dictate, and then his secretaries would type them up. And then for a couple of years, he even did sort of copies of things in a letterpress book made for recording correspondence. So I'm not even joking when I say thousands of pages. Unbelievable resource. It's a really good journal, too. He was one, especially in key points early in his life. The period between when John Taylor dies in exile and when Wilford Woodruff is made church president, there's a very complex, difficult period in which Mormon leaders are in exile. They're arguing with each other. There's a lot of tension around the Wilford Woodruff presidency, and it's more with George Q. Cannon, but you have apostles full on arguing with each other. And Grant would write in detail about this.
And just as a TLDR for our listeners who don't know much about Heber J., so of course he, what number is he, prophet?
Let's see, he is 7.
So,
of course, because in the days of the 7th president.
That's right.
How could I forget this?
It's a whole fundamentalist lore to it. But he, like Brian mentions, he is born in the 19th century. He's the son of Jedediah Grant, Brigham Sledgehammer, who led the Mormon Reformation. You know, the crazy one that really loved blood atonement. Jedi dies when Heber is born, is about like 6 months old, right? 6 months?
No. Very, very young.
Very
never
young.
Knew him.
He's never raised by him, thank goodness. I think the church would be in a lot worse position if he was.
Where did he spend a lot of time, though? At Brigham Young's house.
Not better. So he's born into sort of this upper royalty. Then, you know, as a young boy, he's in the changing church, Brian's favorite time, this conflict of Mormon fundamentalism. He grows up with Mormon fundamentalists and then has to sort of reject Mormon fundamentalists. He is a polygamist himself, but when he becomes a prophet, he's widowed, so he's monogamous. Mm-hmm. But he was like the last polygamous prophet, but he's up into the 1950s, you know, running the church. And He struggles with all kinds of things. He's addicted to beer. He has to go dry out in early rehab. He struggles with sex and ideas of shame and masturbation and all that kind of stuff. And so you see all of those things in his journals, which is really interesting.
It's not often that we get this detailed of a journal. People that, you know, if you take the whole pool of Mormons and then say, all right, of that pool, how many kept journals? You know, you weed out the majority right off the bat. And then of those that did keep journals, how many kept journals for essentially their entire adult life? I mean, that circle is now getting real small. Of those that did that, how many write a pretty detailed, often introspective, often candid journal? Again, like this is now a very, very small pool. And to have that made available really is impressive. And kind of to your point earlier, that includes things that are complicated, things that are tricky, things that aren't cut and dried. And so that, to their credit, like this is a complicated record that's now on the table for everyone to use. And you know, these people that we know, friends of ours, these are the kinds of people that we know, right? These are people who are interested in history. They're interested in telling the whole story. And things like this, developments like this, are a testament to changing perspectives for the good. That doesn't mean neat and clean.
That made me think of something, because Heber J is a perfect example of this. So like when we talk about people hiding church history, right? And Brian says it's not the historians that are doing it. When you actually put historians in the office, they don't do it because they understand the development. And I'll give you an example from Heber J's life. I just talked about him being addicted to beer, right? So early development of Word of Wisdom allowed for drinking alcohol. Most of you, if any of our listeners, know this already, but some don't. The Word of Wisdom was more of a suggestion when it was started. And so in the late 19th century, early 20th century, it was not uncommon for many members to imbibe in alcohol and coffee. As it gets to World War II and past World War II, and definitely under Heber J. Grant's tenure, he's responsible for updating sort of the modern Word of Wisdom. That changes. Now, if you're not a historian and you don't know that development, but you are a Mormon who grew up knowing beer was bad, if you read Heber J. Grant's journals and see the beer, you're going to want to hide that because you think that that's like some secret that he was keeping. If you're a historian and you read that, you see it as a development. So the morality and the shame that other people might put on it, a historian is not putting on it because they have a better understanding. And so that's what we're dealing with now in the historians department, to a point. We were just talking about some polygamy apologetica that's coming out of some church historians' viewpoints that I disagree with very strongly. But I do think that argues that the church historians that are trained and that are in the church history library right now aren't as ashamed of these things and aren't interested in hiding them, because to them, it's not this transgressive thing. It's a progressive thing that happens over time.
And what was so interesting about this release is it wasn't just the Grant journals. Along with it, the announcement on the historical department's website was the public release of a policy change. And this is interesting because people in the community of Mormon historians had seen parts of this taking place, but it was really interesting to see it articulated. So we wanted to share that with you. So the policy said, following direction from church leaders in 2018 and to enable clearer communication with and expectations of researchers, the Church History Department developed a plan to more consistently release the historical records of past general authorities and officers, GAO. What would a good release be without a new acronym? I thought that was interesting.
GAO.
GAO, so general authorities and officers. To ensure we comply with privacy laws and to protect confidentiality, 70 years following the death of individuals was established as an acceptable waiting period before releasing their historical records.
70? Why 70?
I think that's...
A 357 thing?
Like? I mean, I think that's a probably not uncommon time period within archival policy more broadly.
I would just love to be part of those discussions of how they
Well, this is so interesting
that
is that opening sentence, following direction from church leaders. That would be really interesting. That will be down the road. I mean, this will become a historical discussion, is this policy change. And it's so interesting because later, when you now have the sources to understand past events, it's always fascinating to me to see who is on which side of discussions. I think one of the more interesting parts of the Leonard Arrington years is learning that someone like Bruce McConkie was actually quite in favor of the historical department being allowed to do their work. Less surprising was learning that Packer, Boyd K. Packer, was not. But sometimes you see people in different lights and realize, oh, they had a different perspective on this than I would have guessed, which I think is always fun. All right, so the rest of the policy. The Church History Department strives to enable church history research by sharing GAO collections as soon as it is able. Preparing these collections for release is time and labor intensive. In addition to the 70-year period, confidential materials must be redacted in accordance with the department's access policy before a collection can be released. We have prioritized the most significant and eligible GAO collections and will release them over the next 5 years. After 2029, we plan for future collections to be released as the general authority or officer becomes eligible.
So confidential materials, what do we know about what that means?
So the way that their redaction policies work, they have a rubric of three things known as SPC. First being sacred. That usually means temple-related things. And that's even evolved because, generally speaking, what that boils down to now is second anointing. That's any time you see, we went to the temple to receive our two
and
words.
And that's why I'm laughing at that one because... I'm not trying to laugh at sacred stuff. It's just
the policy behind
it. It's the policy behind it. So the church, God love them, will try to redact sacred things like second anointings. And so someone who doesn't know better redacting it, even a well-meaning historian, will not always know their codes and acronyms that others of us might be familiar with. And so you'll be able to still find those sacred things unredacted if they're not looking for all the codes. But they're getting wise to us.
And that's so interesting because rather than becoming less or becoming more, what is the word I want? More liberal in discussions of it, it's far less so. If you look at
probably because I'm mocking them.
Well, if you look at 19th century records, they felt much less compunction to not talk about things like this. Mentions in the 20th century or in the 19th century, I mean, are all over the place.
They were
journals, minutes.
It reminds me of Mormon fundamentalists. The thing that I appreciate about them, disagree with them on blood atonement and polygamy and all those kinds of things, all you want, but they're not afraid to tell you what they believe. LDS are a little bit like, well, we don't talk about it, but fundamentalists are like, yeah, we're not ashamed. We believe in blood atonement. Not a fan of that, but at least they're not ashamed to do it. Our guys
disagree.
Go for it.
Do you want to talk to somebody from the order about the 1940 New Year's Day meeting?
All right, fair enough.
Good luck getting discussions of that going.
However, don't you think that they are more proud of those doctrines than our guys are?
Some of them. Are more restrictive on others.
The Kingstons are a whole different brand, though.
It goes beyond just the order, I would argue. But and that's another discussion, is how different communities view access, view what is sacred, how to talk about sacred. That's an interesting one. I mean, we've talked about some things like that. That's an interesting discussion about like the word of wisdom, you know, differing attitudes on that. And so different communities seeing how they treat the sacred.
You know what I feel bad about is when we went to BYU and we got to look at the Richard Anderson papers, which was incredible, and we had a good time.
That it was.
I went to Facebook like an idiot, and in my defense, like everyone's all like, she just is doing it for attention. In my mind, I was like, church isn't listening to me. Like, they don't care.
Yeah.
But historians I know follow me. And I was like, hey, guys, you all got to go look. And here's all the things I found. And I got really excited. And BYU went and shut it down. And I'm really sorry. I felt like I thought I was doing a service to history. And I was not. I feel really bad about that. So sorry, everybody. Sorry, history, that I did that.
Back to our trinity here. So that's our S, so sacred. Then we have private. And then the third one is confidential. And those two kind of overlap. That is sort of priest-penitent kind of ideas. Like if a lot of that is discussions of excommunication or church discipline. But what's interesting about that is even attitudes on that have evolved. So a couple of thoughts on that. One is rather than redacting, say, like a whole page or a whole paragraph about a discussion of church discipline, often the practice now is to redact the person's name or like what ward or stake they were in that could be used to identify them so that historians can see what was going on. And so that's kind of an interesting change, too.
That's also like a really arbitrary one, too, right? Because someone's excommunication, which is seen as private now to a lot of people, was very public then. Back to Richard Anderson, don't you think that most of what we read would fall into that? Like, I don't feel like we saw anything sacred. We might have saw private stuff.
Yeah, not so much sacred, but yeah, definitely some things along those lines. Now,
that was BYU Library, by the way, right, which is a little bit different.
Very different down there, definitely. Now, what's so interesting about that, too, is, again, attitudes on that have changed dramatically. Because, obviously, through the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, they published notices of excommunication in the Church News, in the Improvement Era. That was the chapter that I helped on Gary Bergera's book, Justice and Mercy. There's a whole discussion, a list of everyone that was excommunicated because it was published. So, again, attitudes go back and forth, you know, sometimes being more progressive, sometimes being a little more restrictive. And that's history too, is policy changes.
Yeah. The private thing is interesting too, because it has to do with like, who it protects and who it doesn't protect is arbitrary, I think. So I wish they would publish. Have they published like what they consider to be private?
Not necessarily. There is a discussion about these policies on their website. But it doesn't give like examples or case studies of like this is you, so you kind of tease it out by seeing what's been redacted. And this was interesting. At Sunstone a few years back, several friends of ours did a panel on the idea of redaction and censoring. And that one was really fun because there was a very recent, very interesting case study with the George Q. Cannon journals. And that was a big deal because those journals had been in the First Presidency control, from what we understand, totally unavailable to all but one family member who was working with them, really. Arrington didn't get to see them. Really, no historians got to see them. But then Church Historians Press, who's also responsible for the Joseph Smith papers, made this unbelievable announcement that they were going to post a more or less complete transcript online. They had started publishing them in book format, but it didn't do well, and so they went to an online format. So they had published a couple batches of them, you know, 5 years here, 10 years here. And then, suddenly, here was all the rest. And this was so fun because everyone was like, oh, hey, there's all the rest. And I remember this clearly because it happened over a weekend.
It was a big deal in the Mormon studies community.
It was
community.
Fun. And because I noticed it, and I was like, oh, cool, I'll poke at this over the weekend. But then when I went back to it, it wasn't there anymore. But of course, friends had grabbed everything. And what had happened is the rest of it had been posted early. And it had some of the fingerprints of redaction committee on it. And so, like, for example, they would mark a whole paragraph with brackets and say, approximately 165 words redacted, colon, 165 words. And that was so interesting because we could sort of see their process of what was considered for redaction and why. And then later, finally, they produced a final version. And again, reflecting this newer attitude about especially things related to church discipline, instead of zapping that whole paragraph, they zapped the person's name and the ward name.
Yeah, so long story short, it was a mistake. They had put them out before they'd redacted everything. And then someone got in trouble. We were grateful, though, that it happened.
It was really fascinating to see both the document, but then also the thinking about it.
Well, yeah, and it brought to mind a few questions for me at the time, which was the things that they redacted, it was like, oh, but why? You know, like, that doesn't bring shame to the church, which, you know, there's this general understanding that the church hides stuff to make themselves look better. The redactions didn't seem to be around that too much. So it was just interesting because we got to see them unredacted and then redacted again. But the other question that I was thinking about, I keep thinking about John Dinger, who his work was criticized because he didn't have access to church documents. And so there is this idea that historians, really good ones like Dinger, we know John Dinger is an excellent researcher and historian, can use what he can, but is limited at what the church gives access to. But then the church can come back and say, oh, your research is false and we have a document to prove it. Well, he didn't have access to that document.
He wanted access.
He absolutely did. And so that is a little bit of a dirty baseball that gets played, which I hope is improved.
It has. And that discussion is really interesting because we see, you know, people change, people evolve, and you know, the line is wavy, but like we're clearly on an upward trend. And that's the, I think the most important takeaway is that access is very much opening. And I thought it was interesting, you know, they point out that this process is time and labor intensive. It is. Unless you have spent a healthy amount of time on the Church History Library's website, you won't really be able to grasp just how much stuff has been made available. I mean, it is millions of pages. And to their credit, like, they don't have to do this. You know, there's no legal requirement to expend this effort. That is a lot of time, and somebody has to do that. And so I do feel that they deserve a really healthy amount of credit for this very helpful and good change.
Unless you think it's easy for church historians, they have to battle the same internal politics that you can imagine that they do, because not everybody does appreciate it. I mean, anyone that worked under Packer's tenure can tell you horror stories about how the men have tried to, you know, there is an effort from some men in the church to want to make the church look good. Some truths are not useful is the famous quote. And back even in Juanita's day, there was this tension between what they allow people to know about the church, about the massacre, for example. So historians are really kind of in a bad position because everyone outside the church is mad at them, says they're, you know, covering things up and sugarcoating things. And yet they have to fight this internal battle to keep it transparent and accurate, which is great. It's good for everyone. I don't think that there's anything that the church has put out there that has really led to its downfall. Opposite. It argues for my approach, which is, listen, you can still be Mormon. You can still have faith. You can still do all of these things. Own up to your history and then learn from the mistakes. And then everybody's happy. If you change the bad stuff, then we're great. It's the people that are entrenched and want to defend the bad stuff that I have a problem with. And then it's taken further to, I think, obstruction or evil when you try to hide the bad stuff or lie about the bad stuff. And historians in the church historians office currently are fighting against that idea, which I think is very healthy.
And as we survey, say, the last 10 years or so, the collections that have been made available are pretty impressive. So we mentioned the George Q. Cannon journals, the Council of 50 Minutes. We talked about in our last episode with talking about Mountain Meadows history. We mentioned sort of an aside that the Council of 50 Minutes, Leonard Arrington wanted to see those, and Joseph Anderson, who Juanita battled with, flat out told him no. He had been given a charge by Heber J. Grant that he was to not let anyone see them, and he didn't.
And they weren't even that interesting, by the way.
They were fun, but they were nothing like kind of what they had been imagined to be.
Yeah.
So those have been published in full with scans available. We are in the process of seeing the George F. Richards Journal being published online. We had scans of the Spencer Kimball journals that were released not too long ago. The complete Emma Lang B. Wells journals. Dozens and dozens of volumes from her. We just recently had the John Widsoe journals. We've had the Brigham Young Jr. journals, the Anthon Lund journals, correspondence from Joseph F. Smith. I mean, just those collections alone are thousands upon thousands of pages of really important sources that are just this incredible gold mine for historians. Things that have not been available before and that will make our history better, more complete, more interesting. So,
and if you want the really juicy, dark stuff in Mormonism, those are the things you're not going to find, unless, like I said, like a Warren Jeffs thing where they're recording stuff because they think it's good and they don't realize how bad it really is. I think the dark and juicy things in Mormonism are when people are self-editing. Think about you as a Mormon writing in your journal. You had dark and seedy sides of yourself that you probably weren't recording in your journal because you thought posterity was going to read it. So it's when people are lying to themselves that they're really self-editing, and we're not getting that. But in church history stuff, it's less that. It's more policy changes and policy discussions. And the juicy tea that Brian and I like are the internal discussions around fundamentalism and stuff like that, because those were not considered seedy, dark, personal, private things. Every once in a while, you'll get those. But usually people are lying to themselves too much to even speak those out loud. So the stuff that you get in church history libraries aren't like Mountain Meadows massacres, exposés, and like confessions. They're a church historian going down to interview Andrew Jensen, like interviewing someone and having him give an official statement that he knows church leaders are going to see. So it's already self-edited by the time that it's there. So it's this weird tension of history of knowing what to find, where to find it. And I don't know, I was thinking about the Brigham Young series that just came out. The Interpreter Foundation has LaJean Carruth stuff.
Oh, mm-hmm.
And you love LaJean because she's a shorthand translator of Brigham Young's sermons, right? And so from LaJean's perspective, she reads Brigham Young as this like very faithful man, very considerate about his family. So she gets that perspective of him, right? Whereas all of the rest of us have a very different conception of, very famously, don't like Brigham Young, because regardless of how he wrote it poetically about his family and about God, his policies hurt my people, right? The everyday poor growing up. So it's interesting to see how a historian views someone, a subject that they're working with, because of the documents that they're working with. And that's going to shape how they tell the story, what they think is worth telling. And all of those things exist in the church history library, so you can go access them on the website today. Like, some random person can go up there, and it's quite remarkable how much is accessible.
So we wanted to share a few things from Grant's papers to give you a sense of what his journals feel like, because they'll tell you about Grant the person, but then they'll also tell you about the development of LDS Mormonism. And also its interactions with other flavors of Mormonism. So one thing that I personally just found really fun is you get a sense for the person of Grant. So one thing that that comes out in his journals is how much, especially as a younger guy, he loved sports. He would go see wrestling. He would go watch early basketball. But one thing he loved was volleyball. And there was a period in his life where he was playing at the Deseret Gym a couple times a week.
I just did a search on the Deseret Gym on the archives. Crazy.
Very interesting place. So
they used to swim naked there. Did you know that?
Grant would get up and do essentially naked yoga often.
A lot of the early, like, there's a whole archive, not in the church history library, but online, you can search it, of gay men in the 1970s when the gym was still open, that remembers going and watching gay swimmers and being like, what is happening?
A little different era.
Yeah.
So enjoy this entry here. He says, from 1 to 2 this day, I played volleyball. Brothers George Cannon, John H. Taylor, Oscar Kirkham, myself, and Joseph F. Smith Jr. are to play a match game during the June conference representing the general board. 5 players from the stake boards in Salt Lake City are to be our opponents. I am a little anxious for the members of the general board to practice as often as possible between now and that event, as I should prefer having our 5 win the game. He was a competitor. One of the more famous stories about him is a kid making the Salt Lake City Red Stockings. This is his persistence story, that and handwriting and singing, right? Like, this was a guy who enjoyed sports and was not happy about them, the idea of them losing. So I thought that was kind of fun. Also on that theme of perseverance. So these are the mythical stories that he loved to tell, but he did them. Another one was singing. he apparently had a terrible singing voice, and so he said, I'm going to make myself into a good singer. And reading his journals, for a lot of his adult career, when he's constantly going to state conferences, he'll talk about how he would sing for them, and they would request him to sing. And I just think, that is just such a different view of like an apostle, right? Like, can you imagine Bednar coming to a state conference and telling you about how he made himself into a good singer, and then he sings you a couple tunes? Like, that's just not something that would happen.
Well, they were also, like, dressing up in all kinds of crazy clothes and doing their own crazy ward shows or road shows. I'm trying to think of the photos I saw, like, all kinds of stuff. Like, they were also playful. As you were talking about it, I was just thinking how boring church has gotten, you know, and is how bureaucratic and, like, official. I have to believe that the brethren are still, you know, boys at the end of the day, and hopefully, you know, being silly sometimes and having fun. But in the early journals, you can see that there's a very human portrait that comes out of these men. And Heber J, I really appreciate. When I learned, again, I keep bringing it up, but when I learned about his addictions, like, you see a very human man struggling with something there.
All right. So his learning to sing, he says, I sang the first verse of 30 hymns on the 6th, and I did so to see if my wife would ask me to stop singing. Some months ago, her health was so poor that whenever I would sing a single verse, she would ask me to stop as it made her nervous. She, however, did not ask me to stop, so after singing 30 verses, I asked her if I should stop. She said she was reading and she didn't mind it at all. I was very glad to have her make this statement, as it shows the great improvements in her nervous condition.
In her nervous condition.
I wonder why she was nervous all the time. Maybe because you won't stop singing. I have to think eventually he still was not that great of a singer. You know, we keep bringing him up. Warren Jeffs, famously, also enjoyed singing at events. Not a great voice.
At least Grant had the awareness to realize that not everyone liked to listen to it.
There's great stories of they would be on these state conference visits, and he struggled with insomnia pretty much his entire life. He would frequently get up at 2 or 3 in the morning, and he was up for the day. And so if they were on the train and that happened, he would kind of get bored. And so he would write in his journal. Sometimes he would start singing. I get the sense of Grant, he didn't always look around and notice who else might be in the room and who that might be pissing off. So there are these stories of, you know, he wakes up the guy who's in the upper berth on the train because he's singing at 3 o'clock in the morning. So
he's one of those. Everyone knows one of those.
So it's just fun. Like, there's nothing like reading a really good detailed journal to get sort of a flavor of a person's life. And this is a good one. Now, there are themes in this journal that also are really interesting. So this first one is kind of fascinating too, because this currently is redacted in line with those policies that we talked about. So this is from 1917. So this is about not quite a decade into the push to discipline post-Second Manifesto polygamists. So he says, at 2 p.m. at the Apostles' Room in the church office building, we held a little council meeting investigating the case of redacted and redacted. Bishop Heber C. Iverson and his counselors and President Iverson of the Emory Stake were present and gave testimony. The secretary of our council, Brother Joseph F. Smith Jr., has the papers in connection with this case. And so this is an interesting one, because in the past, if this had been released, there's a good chance that entire paragraph would have just been zapped and we wouldn't have anything. Now, thanks to Mike Quinn's excerpts, we know that the people being talked about are a guy named George Hickman and this plural wife, Zina Wolf. And so it's really interesting, because we have other records that even if things are redacted, whether or not we agree with those policies, sometimes we can even figure out what they're talking about, which is fun. So then as we fast forward about a decade, as he is now president of the church, we get to see him as this, in fundamentalist eyes, hated persecutor of fundamentalists, who could not believe that this former polygamist himself would be going after them. So this is 1928. He says, I wrote a brief letter to Joseph W. Musser answering his impudent letter. I would call it, to say the least, intimating that the church is casting out the best blood of the church by cutting people off the church who are entering into alleged plural marriage, notwithstanding it is prohibited by the church. And so his journals demonstrate how he goes from being this ardent defender of polygamy earlier in his life to the point that he is fined. He's sent on a couple missions out of the country so that he doesn't get arrested, to turning into the persecutor of fundamentalists. And his journals document some of this.
And that's where the seventh president comes in. It's a whole thing. I mean, the idea that he is foreordained to bring down God's true church by destroying polygamy.
He is not well liked in fundamentalist circles for very clear and understandable reasons. All right, so now 1930.
Honestly, the worst part about Heber J. Grant is his first name is Heber. That's it.
That was not a mistake that he was named that, that's for sure. Okay, so 1935, Mrs. Ella Ship Musser called. So this is Joseph Musser's plural wife. Had a long talk with Brother McKay and myself, and after Brother McKay excused himself about noon to go to an appointment, I told her frankly about the lying of John Y. Barlow and others with whom her husband is associated, and that his letter to me was an insult. The idea of pretending that they are right and the church wrong, etc. I talked very plainly to her. I feel very sorry for this woman. She is a splendid good woman, but of course feels very proud of her husband no matter what he does. So this comes as an interesting time, 1935. This is the first time that with some level of cooperation from LDS officials, there are fundamentalists who are actually arrested and sent to prison. And this will keep ramping up, and church leaders will be quietly, less quietly helping with these efforts by providing information. This is part of the reason, again, that Grant is disliked. Then, this one is really interesting because there is a persistent rumor, especially throughout the 1930s, that Grant had actually married a secret plural wife late in his life. And we talked about how, you know, two of his wives had died, so by the time he's church president, he's back to being a monogamist. So he says, this is 1934, John Fitzpatrick called, and we had a long visit with him. He had a letter from a man by the name of Emmett in Idaho. I think it was asking for information as to whether or not I had taken a plural wife. So there are pamphlets that are published throughout the 1930s that will persistently allege that Grant had married this woman. And he doesn't seem to have.
That's what I was going to say. As far as I know, he didn't.
No. And what's interesting is there are rumors like this about his colleagues. So J. Reuben Clark has a secret plural wife in Mexico. David O. McKay has a secret plural wife. None of these seem to be true, but the rumors are extremely persistent.
Those might not be true, but some of his others did have secret plural wives, which is why it's so messy.
It's hard because this process of the LDS Church deciding they really truly are done with polygamy as a lived right here and now practice, that is very messy. And that involved a healthy amount of secrecy, lying, doublespeak, all these things, so that when they're like, no crossies, I mean it this time, that's very hard to convince people. And you see that in his journals. And that's, to me, that's one of the most interesting parts. And again, we've had little bits and pieces of this, but now with the full journals being released, we can see his position on this evolve over time.
Yeah, well, and you see the church historian's office evolve over time, too, in what they will allow. But to our whole point of this, you can go find this stuff now online. It's really fun. You sitting at home, go try it out. Just do a keyword search, see what comes up. You'll be surprised, actually, what they allow. And I think it's kind of fun. So thank you, church historians, for continuing to be more transparent. And hopefully, the current leadership will also be more transparent and honest with themselves as they're recording their history.
If you like Mormon history, if you like researching Mormon history, if you like writing Mormon history, it is an unbelievable time to be around. The amount of things that you can sit down, pull up your computer, and access like that is amazing. We don't have to find a secret underground roll of microfilm with crappy quality. And use that. We don't have to rely on transcripts that may or may not be accurate, we have full color scans at fingertips. And as part of that, I think that does put a responsibility on those researching and writing. That means our history has got to go up. Our history has got to be better because we now have less excuse, right? We have so much stuff at our disposal. That means historians have got to be using it. There is nothing that drives me more nuts than seeing a new book come out. I open it up and it becomes readily apparent that this author has done minimal archival research, whether that's physically walking into an archive or digitally walking into a source and mining it.
There's so much digitized. And if there's not, I mean, the rate at which they can digitize something for you is very quick now. I've noticed even in the, 7 years I've been working on Juanita now, it's so much faster. But Juanita had to take the night bus to look at one document. And I can go get hundreds and hundreds of documents in one, you know, search online right now, which is incredible.
So our moral is it's a wonderful time. The Mormon history is got more tools in the arsenal than it ever has. And it's very exciting. And for people who really appreciate the art of digging, it is a wonderful time to be able to do this. So we are very happy that this stuff is coming out. We look forward to more coming. We hear rumors all the time about what's next on the horizon, and it's fantastic. So our history, our narrative histories, our documentary histories are going to be more complete. And part of that is that gives us access to different voices, right? As more women's journals are being digitized, as records of people of color are being digitized and accessed, that's going to make the history more complex, more vibrant, and just better overall. So we're very happy about this. Won't you send destroying day nights, Brother Young? Spill my blood upon the earth, oh Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I beg you, spill my blood, oh Brother Young. And let it smoke ascend to heaven, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. And let my breast be cut asunder, Brother Young. As an offering for my sins, a smoking incense, Brother Young. A blood atoning for my sinning, Brother Young. 'Cause I sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young.
The song you heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by an artist, Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com. And consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.